Hello.
Lovely Lucia. How are you?
Fabulous, fabulous.
I was thinking today that we should just start this podcast episode with you singing a version of What the World Needs Now, and then substitute for Love, Lucia, Sweet Lucia. Because that is really what the world needs more of right now. I was like,
It's the only thing that there's just too little of.
yes, indeed. So if you could just take it from the top, I think that would be a great introduction.
Do you really want me to?
Yes, I think, why not? I mean, come on, let's bring some music into this thing.
All right. What the world needs now. I still think it needs love, though. Is love, sweet love.
And Lucia.
And it's the only two things that there's just too little of.
Which is total lies because there's too little chocolate as well, and a few other things. But I'm so happy that you're with us, and your voice is even better than I imagined in my brief introductory dream.
Oh, good.
So, welcome to Mental Notes from
Thank you.
my minivan. Lucia Ratliff is coming to us from Dubai. And she has been part of the Mental Notes from my minivan process since it was just a twinkle in my eye. When we,
Fabulous.
yeah, actually, you were supposed to be the first person on.
No way. Oh, I'm so honored.
You were, because you were working out my jingle. Remember? And
Yes,
she
no, I
wrote
still
this
have it.
whole, like, really amazing sort of song that I am not worthy of, but I like, and I'm still hoping to make a reality.
Yes, this deep metaphorical thing. And then when we actually looked into what could be practical, we had to shrink it down to mental notes from my minivan. And I still haven't finished it.
Well, you know what? It's always nice to have a goal and a dream. And I think it's keeping us both going. So anyway, it'll happen. I have full
Yeah.
faith in that. So Lucia has been my friend for a super long time, not long enough, but it seems, when did we meet? Way back in
Gosh,
the
like
early,
2010-ish.
oh, I was singing before that. Okay. So really, that
Well, I mean, it's
seems,
2018.
I know, it just seems longer because I can't imagine life
Some
without
people
you.
just feel like you've known them your whole
Yeah.
life, right?
And
I
that's
feel
ex
that way with you, Kirsty.
exactly. And it was interesting because Lucia said, well, what should we chat on? Or I said, what do you want to talk about? Because I really do prefer that I don't have the idea of what people talk about. They have something that they're passionate about because we're all way more compelling when we're talking about what really floats our boat, right? And
Yes.
so I was like, well, what is it that you want to talk about? Because I can think of many things. And so she sent me a list of things that might be good podcast fodder. And I was like, all of it. I can't decide. All of it is good. Talk about all of it because it's all great. And then yesterday I put up a Facebook post because I've been considering how, what a bad, well, I shouldn't say bad, but how I could be so much more of an effective helper in the world. I believe if I were to chime in less with solutions or personal anecdotes that indicate that I know where you're coming from, where it might be better just to shut up, right? And Lucia had said to me, oh no, but I love that you, what did, how did you put it? I've always felt understood.
Yes, because you, when I tell you about something that's hard, you're, we must fix this. We must rally the troops. You know, you're being indignant about what I'm
Yes,
suffering. It makes me
indignant.
feel like Like, I have been validated. It's okay that I feel this way. Thank you, Lucia,
because that's what I'm trying to get across. And the reason why I've always felt like that was kind of a good way to show empathy and investment in the person is because this is what Lucia has done for me. And there's few people who have made me feel as understood in the process as she has. Oh. And so you verbalized exactly, and I'll tell you precisely one of the best moments and the most comforting moments where you brought your light into my life was It was shortly after, it was during May, my scary month of May, and to add to the mayhem of May, my father-in-law had just died, and he had died unexpectedly, and it was a big shock and a huge loss to us all, and I was feeling very, very bereft and sad on every level, and also angry because I felt like we hadn't had sufficient support from members of the church. Like, nobody had called at that time to offer condolences and blah blah blah. At that moment. And the thing is, I was already pretty disillusioned towards the church, and Lucia is and was still very devout, happy Mormon, and her response so warmed and encouraged me and just made me feel truly unconditionally loved, because she did not go into defense mode as so many other people do when it comes to the church, our church in particular. She listened to me without any kind of agenda, and then I said, and she saw, I think probably saw through the anger was just pain.
Yeah.
And loss and sadness and grief and insecurity and just feeling a sense of abandonment had been triggered, and I was in a bad place. And she didn't say any of that. She just said, I'm so sorry, and I feel so badly that this is terrible. You know, she looked just as outraged as I felt, and she wasn't angry at any one person. She was just like, this is a terrible situation. And in the end, everybody was highly supportive. I have to say, people were so amazing to us from the church after that, you know, after I voiced my grave, grave dismay. And, you know, it was just that everybody's human and it was bad timing and all that stuff. But I don't know if I ever told you how much that meant to me and what a lifeline that was at that time.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah, it really is. And so that's a gift. And I have always found that both you and your husband, I don't know why my house sounds like it's falling down right now. It might very well be.
I sound like I'm at the NASCAR Grand Prix, so it's fine.
So if you guys, if anybody's hearing, you know, the house literally sounding like it's falling down, it might well be. So you're here for it. But anyway, I was just saying that you and Jay are remarkable people. Because, as I've said, you throughout all my phases of leaving the church, from sadness, disillusionment, confusion, anger, rage, all of it, you guys have, I've never felt like I couldn't speak how I felt. You've never sold out your own beliefs. You've never made me feel uncomfortable with mine. I've always felt validated. I've just always just felt right. And somehow you managed to keep the balance of that, which I think is so tricky. And it's never felt weird. And I just can't tell you how much it's meant to me. So with that said, there's many other wonderful things you bring to the world. You are a musical genius, as we've heard. You are funny and interesting and colorful and have lived quite the little life of adventure and triumph and all sorts of things.
I'm glad you think this, because I was trying to think, like, I was gonna send you a message. I'm sure maybe we should wait till I do something more interesting. There's probably somebody more interesting you could talk to today.
Nonsense. never. So, and also I must say that Lucia always, like, if there's a movie she thinks I should see, she never gives up on me until I do. So if you've ever seen me do a Facebook movie review, it's in direct response to Lucia. Those Facebook movie reviews are always for Lucia and JR after Aaron and I do indeed go see the movie. So if you enjoy my Facebook movie reviews, please thank Lucia. If you don't, then that's your problem.
It's my fault.
No, yeah, it's too bad. It's my Facebook. But no, I mean, you bring a lot of light and color into my life. But you've had quite the life. And I've always been aware that it's been like varied and colorful and full of a lot of intensity, but not never more so than when you sent me that list. I was like, what? Okay. So start at the top of the list and just roll with it. I'm just going to let you take it away and maybe ask clarifying questions from time to time.
Okay. So I don't have this. I have my list is sketched all over a page. So what's the top of the list on your list?
I've got to like now go over onto the list.
No, don't worry. Okay. Here. Let's start with the rattlesnake babies. Should we start with this?
Yes.
So this is just an important story of my life because I love it. So when I was maybe two, we lived in southern Utah, and there were behind our house these bushes, and they're rattlesnakes that used to sun out on the bushes. And just one time I went out and the baby rattlesnakes were out, and I thought that they were worms, and I was so excited, and I gathered them up in my hands and ran into the house to show off these amazing worms. They were the biggest worms I've ever seen.
Were they making like rattly sounds?
Well, the babies don't have rattles yet, I don't think.
Oh boy.
I just thought for sure they were worms, and just probably took 10 years off my mother's life. They called Fish and Game. They put them in a jar and they're like, oh, these are rattlesnakes. And actually they're a lot more deadly than the adults because they don't control their venom. So I've always felt like
you had a near brush there, girl. Like
I am on borrowed time.
Yeah.
From the beginning.
Wow.
Well, even before that, though, actually, when my mom was pregnant with me, so I'm the youngest of six, and she had a lot of health problems through all of her pregnancies. But I had a really long umbilical cord, and there was a knot in it, and it didn't get tighter. It just got longer. And so it just kept growing and growing, and it got me so tangled up in it that when they did the ultrasound, it looked like I had like a foot growing out of my head, and I was missing an arm, and they were sure I was going to be just a complete vegetable that I was just going to be a drain on public funding and that it would be better if they just terminated me because I was, you know, my quality of life was going to be awful. But my dad's a staunch Catholic and my mom's a very devout Mormon, and they just couldn't even think of that. And they just thought that they would just love me for however long they had me. And so they had lots of specialists at the hospital. And then I came out just wrapped up in a cord and I was totally fine.
That must have been the best surprise ever.
Yeah, yeah. I think they were
They were pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what more can I say to that then? Wow.
This is maybe my strategy in life. You just set the bar really low. And then you exceed everyone's expectations.
You're like, I came out with limbs and everything.
Aren't you glad?
Wow, yeah, and anything you brought into the house from then on was not a rattlesnake.
Not a rattlesnake, yeah, no
problem. Probably got away with a lot of stray animals and things like that. Speaking of stray animals, we now have a dog added to our family who doesn't abide by the podcast rules that everybody else does. So
he's beautiful.
He's in and out, and you might hear him bark. I'd add that while we were talking of animals. I'm super glad. I'm even more glad you're here then, considering how close we came to you not being. So were you born in southern Utah?
Yeah, so I was born in southern Utah, but we moved when I was three to California. Okay. So my dad being Catholic, also he's American of Mexican descent. Okay. And so he really felt like the odd man out. He struggled with PTSD really bad after Vietnam. And so southern Utah was just not a great place for him to have help he needed. Right. And so we went to San Diego, which is where he grew up, and they had a lot better resources with the Veterans Affairs and things like that. So really, I grew up in San Diego. Okay. I just have a couple years of surviving Utah.
Yeah, because I'm thinking a Mexican in southern Utah also probably. Well, how was that culture for you?
very difficult. And yeah. And not just Mexican, but also a Catholic Mexican. Yeah. You know, yeah. It was just...
That's a lot.
And admittedly, he had a lot of struggles. There were, you know, there was domestic violence and things like that that were, you know, a result of his own traumas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just... It wasn't a good situation.
So you had a pretty sort of rough childhood on that front too.
Yeah, me, not as much as my siblings, but because I was small, I mean, I was 3 when we moved. And so by the time I was 4, we had family therapy and, you know, better access to things. So I think of any of my siblings, I got for sure, I have the charmed life.
Mm-hmm.
Out of them,
because dealing with, you know, a dad with PTSD and that sort of must have colored the the mood of the home quite a bit.
Oh yeah, for it definitely did. And I mean, he really struggled with his temper and just his emotions, but it's, you know, it was a strain anyway, you know, culturally and emotionally and financially, you know, to have
and religiously was it a,
and
was
religiously it... yeah, of course, because it was always you know, we didn't fit in with his Catholic family and he didn't fit in with our Mormon family, you know. It was just you know, you can't really please anyone.
So the children were all raised Mormon, is that correct?
Well, everybody was baptized Catholic.
Okay.
Except me. I'm the only one that didn't get dunked as a baby. But and then they just kind of picked where they would go. My sister, I think she got baptized a bit later when she was 10. She went with my dad until then. But I mean, my dad's their stance was always, you're going to either be a good Catholic or a good Mormon. Those are your two choices.
Huh. Well, I guess there's worse things to be.
Yeah. So it was, you know, pick one, be one of those things, but there's no in between. You have to be, you know, good at one or the other.
Okay. So there were high standards expected.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Wow. So that's, I guess, I don't know of a lot of households where both the parents were really invested in their separate religion. That's got to be interesting, because usually there's one sort of lapsed Catholic who doesn't go to church, and then there's one invested Mormon, you know. But if them are really into their religions, and that's a bit.
I don't know that I know of any either, but they sure were. My mom is super Mormon, and my dad is devout. I mean, when he comes to visit us, the first things he does is look up the Catholic Church in the phone book, because he's attending Mass, you know. It's
wow. And so wow that actually helps me to understand how you've been able to sort of really roll with me better than a lot of my Mormon friends have been, because you're kind of used to it. I won't ever say that when I left the church, I was abandoned by Mormon friends. Of course, there were some who just couldn't roll, you know, but they sort of quietly went on their way. And then there were others who were just, I think, very much pained by hearing me when I was going through my angry phase, really bash on the church, and they just couldn't hang anymore. But you were just completely the same. You didn't, you know, you were as present in my life as ever. You didn't unfollow me on social media or whatever. And
I've heard it all from my Catholic side of the family.
You've always been, to me, you seem very devout. Like, you don't seem to have any questions about the Mormon church or any unhappiness about it. And you just kind of roll along. And I was always like, wow, how does she find... She seems to find this pretty effortless. I wonder why. So that must have helped.
Yeah. I mean, it's always been a choice. You know, it's always been something that I do because this is what I picked. And it's been a very positive, happy, you know, experience for me. So for me, it's been, you know, that it's the natural thing for me to do. And it's really, I don't know, maybe because we had such hard times, and a lot of times my respite was...
Yeah,
church,
that's
or
what
the people
you wrote.
I knew from church.
That's what you wrote. Your respite certainly seemed to be found often within the church.
Yeah, so I mean, that's really been positive for me, you know?
Yeah. So you have sort of a lot of loyalty based in your experiences as a child.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, all growing up, but I think.
Aunt?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I kind of felt like I think in metaphors, right? We have this in common.
Yes.
And when I was thinking about this later, I really felt like there were a lot of things that maybe I didn't have that other people had, or things that I didn't get from my immediate family, but I got them from other people when I needed them. And so I kind of envisioned this like patchwork quilt of all the love that's intended for you. And maybe a lot of people get it from their immediate family. And I got little pieces of it from all sorts of people. And it was that much more beautiful because of it, you know?
Yeah. That's lovely. Like
this lady at my church, Aunt Nita, she's so great. She just appointed herself to be my aunt, and she would take me out on my birthdays. All my other siblings have godparents because they were baptized Catholic.
Okay.
And I didn't. And I always felt like, oh, I don't have a godmother. That's one less present at Christmas, you know. But but she just made herself part of, you know, she just made herself close to me, and she used to sit with me in church and play tic-tac-toe, and she would take me out for my birthdays, out to eat, and take me to the zoo, and she got me my first bank account, and she put me in piano lessons, and I mean, she really just stepped in
wonderful.
And loved me, you know.
And you know what? I have to say, my kids have also, with the lack of family, because we've always lived so far away from our family, my children have also benefited through having these sort of faux family members that they found at church. So
surrogates.
We have certainly benefited from the church in that way over the years. Our children certainly had a sense of family because of their grandparents. Or we had different people also acting like aunts. And those people are
people
so,
love you.
So precious and needed. Really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and my other, and a few other of the big pieces of this patchwork quilt were in high school, one of my friends that I met in, you know, church seminary, she went to a different school, but their family kind of just took me under their wing, and I would go to her house every weekend and, you know, be part of their family dinners after church on Sundays, and just have this like level of functionality where I always felt so dysfunctional, but I could just go somewhere and be part of something that felt just very normal and functional. And they helped me do all of my college applications,
wow.
You know, everything that needed to be done. They just sat next to me and held my hand and did it with me, you know.
That's amazing.
And actually her dad, Pop Martin, he is an amazing woodworker, and he, for his four daughters, he made these beautiful cedar chests, and people used to always ask him, you know, try and commission them because they are amazing, but they're this huge labor of love,
right?
And they're such a pain in the butt that he never would make one for anyone ever, you know. He said, this is just something I do for my daughters, and you couldn't pay me enough to do it. It is not fun.
Right.
I only do it because I love them. And my senior year, he made one for me.
Oh my word, that is so beautiful.
You know, he made me a cedar chest, and
that
just to show me, I know, isn't it
part
beautiful?
Of the family? Oh, that must
yes.
Be the
no, you are one of my ever. Girls. You know,
because I was going to ask you. You know, there is something when your family is dysfunctional and going and hanging out with a functional family that. You know, it's nice, but then also it's got to feel very lonely. You know, like I'm not, it's so nice. I wish I was part of this. I always imagine. But
I mean,
I was going to ask you if there was anything of that, but it sounds like they really integrated you.
Well, they really did. And the thing was, because they just allowed me to be part of it, I think it would have been hard if they would have said, oh, yes, you can come now, but we're doing family dinner, so you need to go home at 7 o'clock,
or,
you know, but they never did. And I always felt, I don't know, there's a tendency to blame yourself when things, when your life is different from other people. And so if they don't if you don't have that in your life, even cognitively, you might be aware it's not your fault, but you feel like there's something wrong with
you. With you. Yeah.
And so just to have somebody allow you to participate in something that's happy and functional and normal gives you that security that, oh, it's not me. I thought it might be me, but it's not me. See, I can function. It's okay.
Right. You know? Right. Wow. That's what a gift. And are you still in contact with them? I imagine you are.
Yeah. Yeah, since absolutely.
You're so good at staying in contact with it.
My Aunt Nita lives in a care center in Utah now. And she's still on Facebook. Whenever I post a video, she always, you know, sends me little Facebook posts. I'm your biggest fan. Post another video. And she's, you know, sitting in her care center.
Oh, so sweet.
Following
me. I love these stories. That's beautiful. All right. So when I met you, you were just pregnant with your youngest baby.
I just had him. Yeah.
You just had him and you had boom, 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 four in a row. Yeah. Much similarly to how I had my batch of four in a row, like 2 years or less apart.
Yeah. Exactly. That's how they came.
And the cutest little family ever, but like it's a huge handful, as we know. Just when everything's going well. And then you were stricken with rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh, stricken is the right word, man.
Stricken is
Yeah. So Lincoln, my baby, was 3 months old, and so we moved across the country and started grad school. My husband started his doctorate. And what other things happened? I can't remember. I mean, I guess I had a baby. That's another thing.
Yeah, but, so it was just 8 years. Yeah.
It was a high stress time. And so then within about a month of us moving there, I had this extremely quick onset of rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease where you're immune system starts attacking your joints. And I had foot pain. And so I went to the doctor and they said, okay, come back next week. And by the next week, I couldn't close my fists. It had moved to my hands. And in order for it to have rheumatoid arthritis, you have to have several things like blood markers and things. And it has to be active in at least three of your joints. Because very active in, I mean, it was like 43 joints.
Oh, within, just suddenly.
Yeah. And it went from nothing being, I mean, I was totally fine other than having, you know, a 3 month old baby, to being like crippled less than a month, you know, and it was hard because we had just moved. And so people didn't really know that we were in crisis. They didn't know that I didn't limp, or, you know, it just wasn't.
General, yeah. Well, because they just didn't know me well enough. Tremendously pregnant, then you go, you know, and so you're sort of shuffling around anyway when we're like 20
years
pregnant. And then you sort of fall off the radar a little bit while you're getting your baby settled. And then you suddenly, I just remember seeing you, I think at soccer, and being like, what is going on with that woman? Like you were sort of lurching across the soccer field.
Oh my gosh. Walking across grass is the worst. Oh, it's like you're walking across a minefield.
I was like, what's going on with her? Why is she like throwing herself in that strange way? Because you were literally
Quasimodo.
Yes. You were lurching along like a zombie. And it looked so bizarre. And I was like, I just remember my mind trying to make sense of what was going on. And then I was like,
you and me both.
Exactly. And I was like, Lucia, are you okay? And you were like, oh, typically just downplaying it. Well, just things are a little stiff or something. And then I spoke to Cindy, our mutual friend, because our kids went to preschool together or something like that.
Yeah.
And she said, oh my gosh, she has such bad rheumatoid arthritis that she'll lie in bed, she says, and she can't pull the covers up. Like, she'll lie there freezing and won't be able to pull the covers up over her, and she doesn't want to disturb her husband by waking him up every time the covers come over. I was like, what? I mean, both of this was so, like, foreign to me that I would have been like howling like a hyena in my bed.
I know, and not even covers. Like, it was like literally the sheet.
Stoicism is just so. I was more overwhelmed by the stoicism that you were showing than by the fact I was like, she doesn't wake up her husband when she's in that much pain and discomfort. I don't understand. It was so overwhelming to me that you had all these little kids, you were alone. And then, wait, let's set the scene better than that. Then okay. Her husband, and she's got all these feral children, just like they were at the feral age, right? And they're running rampant with the 3-month-old. You're a cripple. In terrible, terrible pain, just out of the blue. And then your husband went and did his internship in New York for...
See, by then it was a lot better.
What? No, it wasn't. It was terrible.
No, it was so much better. The thing is that you guys never saw me when I was at my worst because I couldn't leave the house. I mean, there was literally, I was so stiff for like the first 4 hours of every day that I couldn't even stand up. JR had to dress me every single day because I couldn't do buttons. I couldn't get myself on and off the toilet. I couldn't even walk unless I was leaning against a wall.
Heavens. Actually, I remember when you did your Quasimodo lurch across the soccer field. You said to me, oh, I feel like a 16-year-old because I've had my steroid shots. This was me at like totally. The best. I remember you saying that and I was just so overcome with like, because I was struggling myself right then with my batch of kids and my sort of mental health issues. And I just could not fathom your strength and the fact that you were still smiling, at least publicly. I was completely like, you seemed like a whole nother species to me. That you were well together. So
it's
tell
just
us
because
what
it
really
was a better
like.
Time of the day. You saw me after the medicine had kicked in. And
yeah, well, it was still dreadful. And you were really like upbeat and sort of, it was incredible. But tell me what that whole, how that all sort of played out and how you felt during that.
Well, the thing is, I was in just crisis all day, all the time. And you know, you can't be proactive when you're in crisis. And I think that's something that has taught me so much because there's so many ways that people could have helped me, but they wouldn't have known to help me. And after having that experience, like I remember going to your house and you being in distress and just thinking like, well, we can't leave her like this. We just can't leave her like this. She doesn't know what she needs. She's in distress, you know?
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, I know that feeling. Actually, recently, a couple of years ago, I was just here with one of my older friends, and she has some severe health problems, and we were in the airport on our way somewhere, and she was kind of just shifting from one foot to the other, and we're in a crowd of people for a church going on a temple trip to the Philippines or something. And I just looked at her and saw how she was shifting her weight from one foot to the other, and I just had this flashback of I know exactly how it feels when your legs can't hold you and you just try to stay standing longer
but they're about to give up.
One leg at a time a break, you know. And I just remember like, oh, do you need help, let's get you sitting down somewhere. And she's like, oh, but we're in line. And I said, no, it's fine, sit down, we'll come get you when we need you. And she really did need to sit down, but we were in a crowd of people and nobody knew that she needed help because they didn't know what it looks like or
what
it feels
like to need the help.
And when you are in crisis, you just can't be proactive. So I think just a lot of that time was just surviving from one minute to the next. I remember one time JR was gone for the weekend to Buffalo and I had Lincoln and I slept downstairs because I didn't want him to be, you know, fall down the stairs or something because I couldn't stand up in the morning.
Yeah.
So I slept on the couch and I remember waking up and like, oh, I had to go to the bathroom. And the bathroom is up a flight of stairs. And I just remember just sitting there for a good 40 minutes, like hoping that I could get less stiff, and I didn't. And then another 45 minutes actively trying to stand up, like sweat beating down my face because I was exerting myself so hard to try and just stand up, you know.
Holy crap.
And just 45 minutes it took me to just stand up. And then I like hobbled across the room and just looked up that staircase and just started crying.
Yeah.
I feel like I had gotten to the summit of Mount Everest, and then
well before that stage.
Well, I probably did.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I just remember, okay, so I, now you do not seem to harbor bitterness about any of this, but I do. I harbor so much bitterness because I remember trying to rally the troops, right? And being like, when I saw you doing your lurch, which was well after the Paris part where things were terrible, and being like, okay, y'all, this is how it's going to go down. Me doing my like solve it thing.
Yes.
And contacting Relief Society president and saying, we need, I'm putting together a list. She cannot be alone. We're going to have 24-hour people. We have enough people in our ward. We can make this happen. And being rebuffed and being like, no, no, this is my deal. I'll handle it. And I was furious and still to this day. Okay. but you were not, for some reason, because to me, this is a huge failing on the part of your friends, society in general, both church, both community. Like, it should not have been that way. And all you talk about, I'm still like, I'm literally incensed right now. My fist is like that you had to do that. That a young mother, that our society has set up, never mind, put aside church, put aside anything, but that our society has set up, that a crippled mother of a newborn with three small children is in a situation where she actually has to climb the stairs to use the bathroom is just ridiculous. You know, it's like, this should not have been. None of this should have been. But you back on this time, and I hear you speak nothing but praise of the missionaries would just materialize when things were at their worst. And there was a couple of other terrible, terrible things that went down, like lack of compassion, where the school system was.
Oh my gosh. No, I'm still in my feelings about that, Kirsty.
Okay, so how come you're in your feelings about that? But you don't feel like we all failed you from, like, in every total sense.
Because that is a stupid rule. That is a stupid rule. So here's what
happened. Don't even get me started about the schools.
The rule is that if you are not there, whether it's 1 minute after the bell, 3 minutes after the bell, you are counted as an absent for the day and the school doesn't get funding. And so they have to sick their attack dogs on you if they lose their funding because you are 2 minutes late. And having three little kids and a kindergartner and not being able to walk or like, you know, so if heaven forbid somebody needed a diaper change and I had to wrestle them, you know, like literally lay on top of them to change their diaper or, you know, and we were 2 minutes late for kindergarten, then I would get those things. And I remember going in one time with a letter and saying, okay, so this says that I have too many, she has too many unexcused absences. What happens if we reach this, you know, you can only have 17. I have 13. What does that mean? What happens if I get to 17? And the principal just looked me in the face and said, oh, we turn you over to the county prosecutor.
I will fight her to this day. I will fight her.
And I just started crying. And I think she was just like, awkward. Well, that's the rule, you know. And I just remember being totally traumatized by it.
Well, okay. So, okay. Right. That aside, and I still, there are so many people I still have to fight. And I will. I will avenge all
Thank
of
you.
This. Okay. But how did you get through this and then so not embittered? Because honestly, there was a failing. There was a failing. There were just so many reasons why you should not have experienced even half the amount of discomfort and crisis that you did. There was so many things put into place in your life in terms of highly what we should have and what we do have in structure. I always refer to as Mormons as we, which I suppose is telling since I don't I don't go to that church anymore. But you know,
as a community anyway,
yeah. As a community, that the Mormon church is really quite slickly set up, and that really didn't work out that well for you.
But and I mean, I think that there's a gap there.
What is it, and it, how can we
the gap from? Is call me if there's something I can help you with, and because you if you're in crisis, you cannot call someone and ask for help. I mean, you just can't. I remember a time, gosh, this was really bad. So after I started to get better medicines, then I had the whole emotional backlash and I got depression really bad. And I had started seeing a counselor and started taking some medicine, but I didn't realize that it gets worse before it gets better when you get on medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in that really dangerous period of when you just start an antidepressant and you're having...
And they're stabilizing.
Crazy swing of your hormones, you know?
Yeah.
And, JR had to go on a business trip, I think. And I just remember coming home, like taking him to the airport and then coming home. And I was so deep in depression, man. I just remember laying on the bed and thinking, I can't take care of these children. Somebody has to take care of these children, but I can't do it. And JR's not even on this side of the country. And I'm going to have to call the police and turn them over to the police.
Mm.
And that was going to be so sad. And I just remember thinking, you know, like, who could I call? I mean, I'm sure there'd be so many people at church. I'm sure that I could have called and said, I need help, and somebody would have come. But I didn't.
It didn't even occur
to me that, because I was in crisis. Because I thought, if I call someone and say, I need you to watch my kids, the next question out of their mouth will be, sure, until what time?
Mm.
And you can't say until indefinitely. I can't mother them, you know?
Like, yeah.
Because it was just like, well, that's not an option. Nobody's right. Set up to just take over your position.
I remember saying that, well, telling my husband when I was in suffering from postpartum depression and also PTSD
at
the same time, similarly saying, listen, friend, no drama here. I just need you to know that these kids can no longer be in my care. You got to find yourself somebody else. Like, I abdicate care. And it wasn't
not because, capable of this.
Right. It wasn't because I don't love them and I'm abusing them or whatever. I'm just like, yeah, hi, I'm noticing that there are these children here that somebody needs to take care of. And it's me. And yeah, I know exactly that feeling. I know precisely that sense of it is the most surreal, hopeless, just utterly just depressing feeling in the world.
Yeah, it was so
realize,
sad.
And it is. It's so sad because you're like, you cognitively do realize this is my job, but there's no way. There's no snapping out of this. Yeah.
And you love them. And you know that someone needs to take care of them.
It's the most tragic feeling in the entire world. I just have so much sympathy for you in that. I honestly wish you had given me a call.
I wish I would have called anyone. But here's what... My story is so many times of being on the brink and having what I need when I needed it, which is why it can still be a positive experience for me. Because what happened was, gosh, I remember, and I really scared myself because before then I'd never had any suicidal thoughts.
Right.
But I just remember thinking, there's no other option. I have to turn them over to the police, but I do not want to be around when that happens. You know, like I'm going to have to hide myself away somewhere.
Right.
So that they don't see me. And, you know, like I can't see this happen. So, so I just remember being and thinking to myself, well, it sounds like it would be painful to slit your wrists. I don't think I want to do that.
Yeah. Not that way.
Yeah, but just that really, really, really startled me that I even had that thought, you know,
yeah.
that I'm ruling out ways.
All right.
And so, I was just so sad, but I was too depressed to do anything about it, luckily. Mm. So,
well, this is the thing that sometimes when you're just that slightly little bit less depressed after you've been put on medication, you're just that little bit more energized, is often when suicides are completed, because people have
when you have enough willpower,
just that little bit of gumption left to actually complete a task. Yeah.
So
horrifying
sad.
As that is. Yeah.
No. Yeah. So what happened was, I was saved by the Bowling Green Soccer Club, because alarm went off on my phone that Brooklyn had a game. And so that kind of dragged me out of my bed.
What?
Brooklyn has to be at a game. So it was just that little bit of reality. Okay, go get your shin guards. I know Nathan said no shin guards. Go get your shin guards. Okay, go get your stuff. You know, that kind of put me in autopilot. And so we went out to the
field.
That
right there would have put me fully over the edge. I would have been like, okay, open a window and out I roll.
It was something else to think about, though. You know, it was something else to do. It was
interesting.
A distraction. And so then we went out to the field, and she had her game, and we waited and watched the next game, and everyone left and all the cars went home, and we were still there because I needed the sunshine and the green grass, and I did not want to go back to that place where I had to face the reality of not being able to mother my kids.
Yeah.
And so I just remember just like praying, like, okay, these kids are going to have to eat at some point, and that means I'm going to have to go home. So I'm just going to wait here. Okay. You know, like, I need something to happen. And I got a text message from Papa John's saying there was a special on pizzas. So I was like, okay, all right, I don't have to go home. I can go to Papa John's. All right, baby steps. I'll go to Papa John's. And then on my way to Papa John's, I got a message from lovely Mackenzie and Wendy and Kristen, who were saying they were out at the intramural fields. Did I want to come have a picnic? And I was like, sure, I have a pizza. I will come. So we went out and just spent the rest of the day flying kites and eating pizza.
Wow.
And they never knew.
They never
that. That I lived that day, you know.
Oh my hell. This story is giving me so many of the feels. I can't even tell you. It's like, because
out of the moment, when you're out of the moment.
No, right?
Yeah, but when you're out of the moment, you can recognize, you know, detached from that moment, I could see, okay, this is okay. It's okay.
Well, if we can move from one place to another, even physically, if it's possible to get a change of scenery.
Yeah, just change something, you know,
right.
And sometimes you can't make that change, but something, you know, something dragged the change out for me. And and that's what I needed, you know, and it was, you know, and times like that are really strengthening to my faith, because I felt like, you know, nobody knew what I needed, but I still got what I needed.
Well, you see, so for me as a faithless wench, I look at you and I'm like, okay, this story is just loaded with a zillion different emotions for me and for people who are listening, right? And it could be published.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to trigger.
No, not at all. I'm just saying it could be a double-edged sword, because people could look and be like, this is this woman who had so many things going against her, and she was in such despair, and still she like got that strength together. She got her shit together enough to get up out of bed and just be like, I'm useless. I'm even worse. I've never had rheumatoid arthritis.
I totally understand.
Right?
No, I totally understand.
You get that. And so
please.
I'm thinking, okay. On one hand, this is beautiful for Lucia, because she can look back and go, for the foreseeable future, for the rest of your life, you can be like, remember when I got out of bed that day? I can do this too. Like, I honestly, to me, that would be such a strengthening thing. So what's your, you know, but then the rest of the world who might at this time really have young kids and not and and be like blowing off soccer on the regular because it just can't.
Well, yeah, I blew off soccer.
All that kind of thing. What would you say?
I would say I don't look at that and feel like I had any sort of strength. I look at that and feel like that was a very weak moment, and it was only an external influence that got me through that.
So you processed that sort of bell kind of like triggered another response in you than it would in me. Because like I said, if I had seen that moment, Benjamin, say my eldest, had soccer, I would have been like, and scene, we're done. That has put me straight
That's
over
it.
The edge. That's it, right
Nail
there.
In the comment.
Yeah, honestly. So it's just so fascinating to me that, I mean, it was perfect. Like everything you did was just right in handling it. Like you got out of the house, you changed your scenery, you hung out with other people, you were in the sun, you got socialization, everything. That's exactly how a person is supposed to respond when they feel themselves spiraling.
But I didn't feel like it was my response, you know? I felt like someone responded
like
for me because I was not capable of that response.
Well, fair enough. I will allow it.
Of course. Well,
my experience. So I give that to you for sure.
And that's happened so many times though, when I didn't know what I needed, but I still got what I needed. Like, okay. So one time that comes to mind is when I was on the operating table with one of those kids and the spinal block went up too high. And so it made my lungs I couldn't contract my lungs, but they have you on oxygen, so you're fine. But it was terrifying, and I was having like a full-blown panic attack. But I'm strapped down and paralyzed from the spinal block, and I can't take a breath. And I just remember telling the nurse I can't breathe, and her saying, "You're talking, that means you're breathing." And she didn't care enough that I was dying. Like, she thought everything was fine, and I knew it wasn't. It was like sudden demise, and nobody would listen to me. I mean, I knew that it would be futile to say, "Stop this now. I need to get together. I can't handle this." Because you can't in an operating room. It's go, 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 go. People are actually dying in the next room, you know? So I just remember praying like, "Please, please, please, I can't handle this. I can't handle this, please." And then after that prayer, what happened was I just got this sudden wave of nausea, and I literally vomited onto the operating table. But the funny thing is, after like 9 months of awful pregnancies, I mean, vomiting, you know, throwing up how many times a day? I mean, there was one time I was at work. I had been at work for 2 hours and I had already thrown up 5 times.
You have like literally not caught one single break in your entire life, have you? I just cannot.
And so I just remember like throwing up, but throwing up put me back in my happy place, because I, you know, this was all foreign and scary, but after 9 months, throwing up is the comfort zone. And so I just felt like
it was,
I would never pray to throw up on an operating table, but I prayed for help, and then I threw up, and that fixed the problem, you know. So
and did it fix the lung thing at all, or did it just stop?
No, because the lung wasn't actually a problem. They had me on oxygen.
Yeah.
So I was breathing. It was just my mind thought that I couldn't breathe.
Oh,
you know, so it was the panic was the emergency, as opposed to the actual oxygen.
So it just sort of created this distraction and the sense of familiarity enough for you.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
I was totally comfortable throwing up.
I just think it's just beautiful that you will take that horrific experience and be like, "Look, see, I was blessed." And I think that is, you know, a huge credit to your resiliency, that you can recognize that you can take, because to me, I don't know. I think if I had been thrown up too, I would have been like, "This is
rude,
and I'm going to choke on the vomit." But, you know, this resiliency that you have is pretty astounding, and you credit it to faith and to being like, okay.
I feel known, I feel heard, I feel loved. So even if everything else happens, and whatever is happening in my mind, is creating this feeling of being heard and being loved. And so it works.
Yeah.
It
You're
works
not totally alone. There's never that sort of
despair. Yeah. And yeah. Well, and I have I have hard times.
Of course.
Obviously. And I have, you know, crappy moments and things when I feel like I'm ruining the universe and stuff. But in the back of my mind, I feel loved. So
that's
why the world needs love, Kirsty.
It really does. It does need more love, for sure. And people need to have that sort of really secure grasp on it, whether they get that sense wherever they from whatever religious
wherever you know go out from. In nature, do you know, wherever you feel peace, wherever you feel loved, like soak it in.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It's life-giving. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So now we've got you, what point in your beleaguered life have we gotten you to? So you're mom of four, with rheumatoid arthritis that somehow sort of got somewhat more under control by the time you left for.
Yeah. So the reason why it took so long is because I was on Medicaid at the time, which was actually a huge lifeline for us, that all those medical bills and tests and things were covered by insurance. But because they only take a certain number of new Medicaid patients and just new patients in general, and one of the rheumatoid arthritis, the rheumatologists in the area had just shut down his clinic, so there was a shortage. So I ended up waiting. I mean, I couldn't even see a doctor about it for 7 months. I mean, and it crippled me within the first month. So just all that time I was just waiting to see a doctor. And that's another reason why I just felt like nobody could help me. There's nothing they could do because I need to see a doctor and there's nothing that can be done about that, you know? And
wow.
So,
wow.
I mean, of course there would have been ways that could have, you know, eased that burden, but I didn't know of anything except for the solution, which is find a doctor to take away this thing, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
And so when I did get to a doctor, I mean, it took him about 30 seconds to say, oh, you have rheumatoid arthritis, pretty severe case, you know? And then we started on medications and steroids and all sorts of, you know, chemotherapy and, just all sorts of crazy, toxic, weird injections and having to learn how to do my own injections and things like that. But after that, it kind of got to a point that it was okay. And then JR graduated. Then we started our adventures.
And do you feel like that was kind of like, you know, how we sort of all go through our phases where in life, and sometimes there's more than one of these circular phases or whatever they are, where there's the dark, dark, dark night, and then here comes the dawn, and we kind of rise like a phoenix from the ashes, and we make more of ourselves.
Yes, yes, Kirsty, I had that exact analogy. I remember thinking when my body started to be able to move again, because I had already kind of mourned that this was going to happen. And I had read all the statistics. And if you have rheumatoid arthritis that's not responding to therapy, then you have the life expectancy of someone with acute lymphoma, or, you know, like just these things that I had read. I remember when I started to be able to move my joints again, like all these little things that I thought were gone. I thought I for sure would never play the guitar again. I remember hearing that corny dance, Cotton Eye Joe, and thinking, like, I will never dance to Cotton Eye Joe again, which maybe isn't a loss, but when
I
those things.
My journey.
I'm a little melodramatic.
No, I just think people are thinking I'm the most callous, awful person, but I know the way you said it in that drama way was just intended to be funny. But
exactly,
it is a pleasure to dance that dance from time to time. And I am so sad for you that you had to feel that way. I didn't realize that it was that way for you.
No, I just remember it coming on the radio one time or at a dance or something and being excited, like, oh, and like going to, you know, just a pep in my step, and then my legs just like laughed at me, like, huh, yeah, right.
Oh,
you can't jump from one foot to the other. What are you thinking?
How old were you at that phase?
26.
Oh, that's so sad. Yeah.
So then when I started to be able to do stuff, I was like, oh, I am a phoenix.
Yeah.
I thought I was going down in flames. I thought I was the worst bird ever. But I'm not. I am a phoenix.
You are, though. You truly are. If anybody is, it's you.
I will rise from the ashes. I have a song about that.
And you are, and you have in so many ways. Like, you're so talented. There's nothing you don't do. Like,
well, so that was another thing that was hard for me too, because I mean, I've always loved singing. Singing was my thing. That was my identity. I am a singer. I mean, as soon as I was old enough to be in choruses and stuff, like, that was my respite. That saved my adolescent psyche, you know? I mean, there were so many things that were hard. But because I could sing, that was my lifeline of, I am of value still to the planet, because I can sing, and it wasn't anything I did. And when you can sing, you can be in plays, and I got to be in like the elite competitive show choir and dance in sequin suspenders.
And as you had always dreamed of.
As I had dreamt of since I was little, which I really did, because the show choir would come to an assembly at my school when I was, you know, kindergarten. Yeah. And I just... They bedazzled me.
So, because you are a big time extrovert. Like, you get your energy from being with people, don't you?
Yes. And that's another thing that people didn't realize I was having a hard time. Because when I was with other people, it was like, sweet, I'm fine. I got my heroin fix of humanity.
Yeah, humanity. Yeah. So this was especially hard on you because it was very isolating.
Yeah. And then when I was with people, like, I was great. I'm totally fine. I got no problems at all. I'm here with the human beings.
So the singing allowed you to be sort of with your peeps as well.
Yeah. It gave me a people. It gave me, you know, a sense of, oh, there's something I can do. I mean,
yeah,
I am falling behind on all these other things that other people have that I don't have. Their projects are beautiful. Mine's crappy. You know,
can you say your teacher put yours behind the filing cabinet?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Yes. So we had to make this mining town in fourth grade.
And of all the things. Right?
And
of all the picturesque, beautiful things, a mining town.
Right? My friend had the most beautiful mining town.
Oh, really?
It was amazing. Her mom had bought her miniature houses and miniature shrubbery. And like little water tablets that you can make so it looks like running water. Oh,
wow.
And I am a creative person, and it just spoke to my soul how beautiful that was.
Yeah.
And mine was, of course, I'd procrastinated.
Okay.
Because nobody knew that it was happening. I mean, it just wasn't really on the radar. Like, me and school and like meeting lunches or doing homework or...
didn't you say you didn't have school lunch for like your whole life?
No. Well, like so we had it when it was like free. And then when we stopped qualifying, when my older siblings went away to college and I didn't qualify anymore, I just didn't have anything for lunch.
And
I
remember, like, maybe think to alert your parents, like, wait, hold on.
I mean, I knew that they were at capacity.
So there wasn't anything left for lunch.
There wasn't something to be done, you know.
Oh, wow.
You know, it just wasn't – it didn't seem like there was a solution. And, you know, like we said, when you're in crisis, you don't know what the solution is. Right. And I just – but I remember feeling like it was my fault. Like, if I would learn how to cook dry beans, then I could bring something for lunch, you know, like
– oh, honey.
I know.
This is so pitiful.
My friends being like, Lucia, you forgot your lunch again? Like, just being like, yeah, I forgot. Well, because I told them I forgot my lunch, you know?
That's a tad insensitive that they didn't pick up after, you know, 10 or 12 times of that that maybe you didn't have.
No, and sometimes they would be like, oh, here, I don't want this apple, or, you know. Yeah. So I was just like that annoying kid that was like scrounging other people's lunch leftovers. And anyways, so that was something. But you know what? The house that we lived in, which someone from our church had organized for us, had fruit trees and nut trees and persimmons and pomegranates. And I remember thinking later, like, well, you know, at least I had that when I went home. And then I just felt like, oh, you are loved. Don't you see? Like, even though you were not on your parents' radar, and maybe I was, but I mean, they were deep into their own struggles.
Yeah.
But I was still on whoever makes the grass grow and makes the trees make fruit, even though no one's tending them, wanted me to be fed. You know, like, it still came out feeling like this is not okay. It's not okay for kids to not have lunch, you know?
Yeah.
But I was okay because I felt fed anyway.
You were nurtured by something out there.
Yeah. So this project, though, it was like, I used like toilet paper rolls and paper that I had like colored brown with a half paper, a half thing of like a brown crayon, and it was awful. And she put it in the filing cabinet. And I remember she put her arm around me and was like, do you see this project? The one with like the water tablets.
I'm
going
to hurt her. I'm adding her to my file.
And do you see your project? Do you see a difference? Do you think you should have done better?
Where is she?
You know what's funny?
You know what? I went to jiu-jitsu this afternoon for the express purpose of avenging all of you. All of you.
Okay. Kirsty, I have to tell you a true story about what happened. A couple weeks ago when I was thinking about this and I was like literally crying on JR's shoulder. I was processing this again. Like, she told me my mining town was not good. And
why
I was
am
like,
I laughing? This is the saddest thing I've ever heard. Am I laughing?
Because it's dramatic.
It's so sad.
So, no, okay, here's the great thing, another sign of the universe loving me, Kirsty. So, that morning in church, we had sung. Okay, so I was like, okay, well, I'm just sitting here crying. I should just read my scriptures and go to bed. That morning in church, we had sung How Firm a Foundation, and it had the scriptures at the bottom. And I was like, oh, I love the lyrics of the song. I should read the scriptures that go along with it. Mental note, read these scriptures. So then that night, when I was having my fourth grade flashback.
How old?
So then I was like, oh, well, I probably need to sleep. So, and then I remember just praying like, Heavenly Father, what did you think about that? Like, I know what it felt like for me, but what did it feel like for you? You know, and just thinking like, okay, well, I'm just going to read my scriptures and sleep, because sleep cures a lot of my emotional outbursts.
Right. For most of us. Yeah.
So I read those scriptures that went with How Firm a Foundation. So I just picked a chapter and read that. And it was like all very soothing and comforting. I will be with you. When you go through the fires, you won't be burned. I will put people in your life. And, you know, specifically said that. And then I was like, okay. And then at the end of this chapter, it said this great thing. And it just felt to me like an internal, like nod to my dramatic side. And it said, like, thy first father hath sinned against thee, and thy teachers hath
scorned thee.
Scorned me. You know, it was like, and it was just like this, like, I will avenge. It was so, and I just remember.
You know
laughing.
What? I feel like I have been personally called upon on this day to avenge you of that teacher. I will find her, and I will avenge this wrong.
It was so funny though that scripture would be what was in the reading that night.
No,
like,
because she did a very ugly thing, and any
that's
teacher
what,
who might be
God
listening,
when I hope that.
Honestly, I don't know any teachers who would be that insensitive, but they tend to be much nicer these days, I think. But, you know, I think this is so good for us to listen to, that kids who are underperforming, it has so much to do with the resources
oh,
that
gosh,
they
yeah.
have.
I mean, if you see a kid that comes in and their
project
is made
is
out
crap.
Of a toilet paper roll.
Like,
maybe.
Maybe, like, put two and two together and don't shame them for it.
But, I
see
mean,
this
I probably...
one that looks like the mom went to Hobby Lobby and bought out the entire place? Now look at yours. I mean, I think that it's funny. You know what I think that I love about you so much is that you are so real about what you have experienced and how truly painful it was. But then you can also put on this, like, you can see the humor in it by, like, really kind of getting dramatic about it.
Yes. I have a talent for dramaticism.
No, but it's,
no,
just
it's
like,
true.
You know, that other people, because it was a horrible moment and that so many other people would have just quietly internalized that. And you've
well,
made,
I did that too.
But you've made it into a story that we can all learn from and maybe seemingly callously laugh at, but not at all, because I am going to make sure that my young daughter, who's still involved in this kind of thing, will always be tuned in to never judge a kid for not having their lunch or not having, you know, a project that's looking as slick as other people's, because it's almost always because of what's going on at home.
Do you want to hear a warm fuzzy, like, addendum to that, though? This will make you feel better.
Sure.
So,
like,
the next
okay.
year we made gingerbread, no, graham cracker Halloween houses. And
you didn't have any freaking graham crackers.
And you had to bring in milk boxes and graham crackers, which I was able to get the graham crackers because there was a note that said you have to bring it. And it was just always easier if you're like, here, look, I need this. My teacher said so. So
okay.
I brought in the graham crackers. And then you're supposed to bring stuff to decorate. And so I had just gotten like a handful of little Red Hots or something. And but all of my friends had kind of rallied around me and gave me their gumdrops and all these things. And I won the gingerbread house competition. And but it was
nice.
All these people. And, it wasn't the teacher, but it was my peers. And then like, oh, yeah, you can have this. Here, have a marshmallow. Here, have this. And because all the, you know, that quilt, patchwork quilt of love.
Yeah.
And even though it meant that I won and everyone wanted to win the competition, but they still let me have their, you know,
were they happy?
Mint
were
pastels.
They, happy with your
they were disappointed that they didn't win, but they still let, I don't know. It was just a sweet thing when I think of, like,
yeah,
the kindness of those people and the times they were like, oh, you can have my apple, or, you know, I mean.
So you sort of, you look back on a lot of this by being like, I was taken in and nurtured by a community of lovely folks. That awful teacher aside, who I will get the name of after this broadcast and event.
But I don't have any, I didn't feel
I know,
any malice.
I
didn't feel like she disliked me or anything. You know, I think she really was trying
She's
to get
clueless.
Me to take more initiative. And yeah. I really was like a procrastinating, like, fuzz bucket, you know. I just,
well, it's a bit hard when you're like malnourished and there's nobody at home helping you out with these things.
Well,
know?
I mean, and it wasn't,
maybe that could have contributed.
We had, I mean, we, it's not like I was dying of starvation. We had dinner every night, you know. It wasn't
okay.
Like that, but you know,
anyway, well,
it's fine. I'm not mad at her.
Tales, to be sure. No, I think it's a beautiful thing that you do look back, because I think it's true. You know, I think it's actually true of all of us who have stories. And I don't think there's a single one amongst us who doesn't have a story that will bring you to your knees in sadness and compassion for a person, even the most fortunate.
Everyone
Everybody
has a struggle.
Something horrible. But many, many of us, and I will say myself included, sometimes just can't see the many, many unseen acts of kindness, goodness, call them angels, call them, you know, whatever it is.
Love.
Love that also intervened, you know, and I think that doesn't serve us very well. when you seem to truly be focused on the light, and I think this is why you are where you are throughout all of this, that you've sort of risen like a phoenix over and over, not just, you know, not just
my phoenix. But it takes a long time, and it's processing it, and you know, it's after the
fact. I love that you said that you still have your flashback and you cry about it on your husband's shoulder, because that's so real. You know, I think, and there's no shame in that. There's no shame in that. And it's not because that particular event was that devastating to you. It's just that it's attached to many other times. It really is.
But,
other,
you know,
times and other beliefs.
I think it's really important to, you know, reflect on things and feel the feelings. But honestly, I think every time I think of that now, attached to that, because I reprocessed that when I was 30-something.
Yeah.
I will now think of not only that, but also that funny scripture, like, thy teachers have sinned against me.
And then you will also think about possibly now you also won the gingerbread house.
Yes.
Extravaganza project afterward and stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, and this is why I'm always plugging therapy, because therapy helps us to look at a bigger picture.
Yeah.
Where we can't see the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm. You know, it honestly does help us sort of go, okay, well, why is this particular thing keep cropping up? Oh, because it speaks to the fact that I never felt like enough.
Yeah.
Or I did not feel supported in school. Or I wanted so badly for my things to be beautiful, but I didn't have the resources for that. You know, it keeps coming up.
Yeah.
And until we really recognize what that was all about, it does keep visiting us every single day.
It becomes part of your identity.
It does. And so I think that, you know, when we do allow ourselves the space and time, and whoever our therapist may be, then we can say, okay, look, that happened. And then we can have a little laugh about it, and we can see how it doesn't define us right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And not be as easily triggered by, you know, when you show up at whatever church or whatever and your project isn't quite on par. You don't have to feel like your fourth grade self.
The fourth grade mining town.
Right. And honestly, that was the stupidest project ever. Why? Like, anything that you have to recreate any kind of town is silly. So I'm just gonna solve that for you right now.
Okay.
Here today. Now I want to talk about where you are presently and how you're relaunching yourself. How old are you now?
Oh, how old am I now?
Age thyself.
I think, woman. I'm 33. No.
Okay.
What year is it?
We're in 20. I often have to wonder. Are we in 2018?
I'm going to be 34 next month.
Okay. So you're so very,
I'm
very young.
I'm a bit old to start a music career.
What? Never.
But I don't care.
You're beginning. This is, you're just in the babyhood of your adulthood.
Yeah.
So, you have recently, in the last few months, I've noticed you are doing all sorts of really bold things for anyone of any age. Say what you have recently conquered, please, so that I don't butcher it.
Are we talking about music?
Yes,
okay.
Your musical all career. Right. And that you just went out there and did this thing. I'm like so
that was
so
fun. So what kind of was the catalyst? No, I mean, music has always been my thing. And when I got rheumatoid arthritis, also my voice kind of went. And it still does off and on. It just kind of attacks. It can attack any part of your body, not just your joints. So, I mean, like, I've had to get my gallbladder removed. I've had random, like, infections in my jawbone. You know, just random things that it's just attacked.
But lovely.
Yeah. Imagery there. And another thing was that it just made it so I couldn't sing. So I thought maybe that part of my life was over. And it was sad, but I was still grateful, because even if the only thing it accomplished for me was to give me a self-esteem in my adolescence, it had already done a miracle, you know. So, so I was happy to let that be on the back burner. I mean, not happy, but I was okay with it. And then, so I started kind of just putting my toes in the water again. And I joined a choir here. That's been fun. There was a competition on the radio for sending in a love message to someone you love. And so I sent in a little jingle that I had just changed the words to the L is for the way you look at me. So I sent that into the radio and they played it on the radio. And then they gave me a gift certificate.
So sweet.
And then, and I was like, ooh, this is exciting. And then the very next day, they sent this thing out saying, we're looking for singers. Send us in a clip of you singing a favorite song. You might get to sing at the Dubai Jazz Festival with Ricky Martin or John Legend or Duran Duran. And I was like, oh, that's so exciting. That would be so cool. Oh my gosh, that would be so cool. So then I just like literally I heard it on the radio. I was on my way to go see a movie. And I just recorded a little thing in my car and sent it to the radio station, and they called me, you know, the next business day and said, oh, okay, what day can you come? And I was like, great, am I in the finals? And they say, no, you're in. So I got to sing at the Ricky Martin concert. It was so fun. I met so Ricky brave. Martin in passing.
And didn't you, but they gave you a whole new song.
Yes, okay. Like it was before. Terrifying. So that they yes. didn't get the rights to the song that I had practiced, which I already only had like 3 days to learn it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get the rights for it. And so the night before, they sent me a list of songs that they had the rights for. I didn't know any of them. So they sent me another list of songs. Like literally those songs that they Google didn't even know those songs. They didn't exist, I'm certain. So then they sent me another list and there was just one song by Adele and I was like
ah. And it's a tricky one.
Like this, and for someone who loves singing to be put on a giant stage and forced to do bad karaoke is like the seventh circle of hell. Like
right.
Oh. If I didn't.
You're like, I know better. I know that I'm not prepared for this.
Yeah, it was so, so scary. But it was too cool not to do.
Yeah.
And so I did it. You know, so I just like stayed up all night and practiced as much as I could and was just like a basket case. I sent a recording to my friend of this song. And it was the best response ever. Her 13-year-old daughter.
Oh, my gosh. I've watched that repeatedly. I've watched
Abby. So I sent this to my friend Emily and was like, Emily, please tell me how bad it is. Should I just drop out? Is this really awkward? And then her daughter sends back this message like, what? You know, just, I didn't know you could
13-year-old. And she was so genuine. She was just like, she was apoplectic.
And I just...
Her amazement for Lucia. It was the sweetest thing.
It was so sweet. And I just burst into tears and just breathed a sigh of relief. Like, okay, it'll be okay. And then I had a choir boot camp the next day. So literally I had to get up at like 6 a.m. and I was in choir boot camp all day. And then I had to like cut out early to go to the mic check. And so, I mean, I had no time. I literally hadn't even had a night's sleep to even like move the song from my short-term memory into my less short-term memory, you know?
Oh my gosh, I didn't even know that was a thing.
Well, yeah, so like, I mean, so when you sleep, right, so then your brain moves these things. So, I mean, I hadn't actually slept more than like 2 hours, so.
Whoa.
And I had to like be up there on stage with this paper and I did interviews and mic checks and they, you know, those mic packs, it like fell down
the back of my legs
while I was singing.
It did.
I had to like fish it out without like sticking my hand down my pants on a giant stage.
It did. I know. But you rocked it.
But we did it.
Absolutely rocked it.
It was okay. My goal was to survive and I survived. And then I mean, only just. Because when I got back to my choir boot camp, they were like, oh, how was it? Do you want to sing it for us? And I just like, oh, it's too soon. I don't ever want to sing that song again.
That song has some connotations now.
It has.
Which aren't altogether soothing. Yeah.
But now it's fun. I love it. So after that, I was like, well, this is fun. I can do this. So then I posted that and the interviews. And that was fun. And so then I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll do more. And here was a big turning point. One of the other people that had won, she was a singer-songwriter. And I was like, what? You can do that? Like, you can just declare that you are one?
Right. You can just say, I am.
And it was just this huge, like, window of opportunity. Like, yeah, I was thinking I have to wait for somebody to tell me that I can sing and that I could, you know, could and sing. And I was like, whoa.
Knight you as, like, the sword of singer-songwriter.
Right. Like, someone has to invite you to do this. You have to win American Idol or something, you know? Like,
nope.
But
I know. But I've always felt that way about being a writer. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But this random girl in Dubai, I asked, you know, we were talking, oh, what's your job? I'm a singer-songwriter. I don't work. You know, I don't have a job. And I was like, what? You can do that? And she sang and she was fine. But I was like, dude, I can do this. What? She just decided she was. I just have to learn how to write a song. So I Googled how to write a song.
You know what? That's how people do stuff these days. They do. They Google it and it is done and then they're that.
So there was a list that I was like, okay, I'm gonna try this. I'm gonna try it. I made a list. I put it on my, you know, summer plans. I'm gonna write a song. And then I saw this thing that was like songwriting challenge, 5 songs in 5 days, free challenge. So it was like, oh, it's free. Okay. So then I started this challenge over spring break and the first day they send you a prompt and I wrote a song and I was like, wait, what? Like, that's all I had to do. I just had to like be told to write a song. And so I did.
Right?
What?
Why do we overthink everything so much? Yes.
So then I just started, you know, just ideas just started pouring out of me. So now I've got this list of like 50 songs that I'm, you know, in various stages of.
And now you are indeed a singer-songwriter.
And now I sing into my iPhone and post it on Facebook. Does that make me a singer-songwriter? I think it does.
Well, if it makes me a podcaster that I interview it people does. On my phone and post it on all the places, then it makes you a singer-songwriter. Yeah.
Well, and that's what I realized was I was waiting for someone to say that I was good enough to enter this sacred space of all this talent.
Yes. Yes.
When really I just
you have to be the one
to make myself available to do that. And then looking back at all the times, you know, like college, I never was put into the musicals. There was these elite groups in college and I just figured I wasn't a good enough singer because they didn't put me in these groups, but I wasn't available during the times that they were, you know, I had it on my thing that I had to work, you know, I don't have someone paying for this for me. I've got to go to work. This is my schedule. And I figured if they liked me enough, they would tell me, please join our choir. And they never did. So I just wasn't that good, obviously.
So you let them sort of define what you were instead of.
Exactly.
And we all do it to some extent. And then one day we go, I think I'm going to stop. I think I'm just going to be who I want to be. Yeah. And then suddenly the universe gets out of the way and goes, by all means, yes.
Exactly. I was like, I just want to sing and I just want to post a song and singing and posting like that first song of just me singing by myself was scary and it's not even very good. And even still, when I hear a recording of me singing, I always cringe like, this is not good. And so then when people say, oh, this is great, I'm always like shocked and surprised. And maybe I can do this.
I think you're awesome. I honestly do. But I do know that we are our own worst critics. And that, you know, we will perpetually stand in our way if we, it's so unrealistic to imagine that we will be discovered or somebody will, you know, sort of.
Somebody will invite you into this sacred circle. Yeah.
Because there's so many people hustling. And honestly, there's so many ways to do it now.
Exactly.
If we don't realize that you can just Google a thing and then declare yourself that thing and download the app on your phone and follow through.
And do the thing.
And promo yourself and bill yourself as that thing. Nobody else is going to.
Exactly.
Right?
Why would they? And just realizing that there was a next thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there was enough space. And that was another thing. Like, she's singing and songwriting. Nobody's telling her she can't. And all these people who were at this music festival, like, these people are all doing music full time, all day, every day. This is their job. Like, there are so many ways to be in music. So I'm going to be in music. I just decided I'm doing it.
Who are you not to?
Yeah.
Right?
So that's what I'm doing. So next show, I'm not teaching anymore. I've given my notice. And next year, I'm going full-time creativity, man. I'm going to try and figure out how to record music from home and, you know, learn what I can learn. YouTube the heck out of it.
I'm so thrilled. And that's the thing. And we are just so lucky to have so many resources at our fingertips.
Oh, yes.
So if we don't get overwhelmed and we don't overthink it, we really can just make stuff happen. And that's the thing. It's just stay focused. You know, just keep it as simple as it needs to be for you to just get going. Just back to the first episode of my podcast. Just get the thing done. Yeah.
Exactly.
Get it done. And then you're on your way. But look at you. I'm so impressed from just all the many, many, many setbacks that you've had in your life and the things getting in your way. You didn't choose to sit there. You didn't choose to sort of, you know, unpack and camp out in the difficult spots. You've sort of looked at the rays of sunshine and all the little rainbow slides that have gotten you to the next the next stage. And here you are, just inspiring and lifting and being. And talk about your name, what it means, and how symbolic that is to you right now.
Oh, so my name means bearer of light. And I always just thought that was like, oh, cruel irony. Like, I'm the most dysfunctional person out of anyone I know in any of my circles. You know, like, I have nothing. But
so unfair.
But I'm, you know, realizing more and more that I can love people. And that's a talent I have. And I can bring that light. And Viktor Frankl was it that said that which is to give light must endure burning, and
wow,
it's true. Yeah. You know, if you are going to help anybody, you know, like if I could not help that my friend in the airport until I had endured the burning that she had experienced, you know, and so right. I have some burning under my belt, and I feel like I can give some light now.
And you know what? And we don't all have to feel all the different types of pain. But listening to, you know, now I will be able to look at the person who's shifting around and be aware of that. You know, if we have the heart for empathy and we have the heart for how can I make this life easier for other people, we don't necessarily have to experience every last bit of pain in the world. And that's, I think, what I just sort of put out there in my Facebook rant. Like, don't be content to sit with, I just can't possibly understand how hard and how sad, and then go along merrily on your way. Talk to somebody who does understand with an open heart and find out what you might be able to do, you know, to help people. Even if you yourself can't go through all the things Lucia has outlined, maybe you take something from, you know, maybe you take any of the nuggets she's given us today, like, don't wait for a person to call you and tell you what they need, because they won't. They cannot. They don't know. It's just not a feasible way of helping people. We need to show up. We need to show up in people's lives. Ready to work and have
and just
eyes
stay
open.
Stay until
the job is done.
Until, you know, until something happens or until nothing happens, you know,
The thing is, I think what I've taken from you, what has been just both healing and informative to me, and something that I can strive to emulate, is your non-judgmental way of loving and being. That you are neither, you never give me the sense that you're sitting in judgment of me.
I don't feel that way.
Anyway, because you don't feel that way. Yeah.
Well, and I
think you're so open. You're just so open to hearing about the experiences of other people without sort of projecting your own your own experiences onto them, which is
I think
very
my
rare.
Upbringing really, really, that was a gift to me in that. And, you know, growing up with sort of, you know, the villain being my father, and then having that relationship be healed and understanding what his, you know, his struggles were.
Yeah.
So,
his demons.
You know, understanding what was so hard for him, and just knowing that even people who are, if you don't understand them, it seems like the villain, there's something else there. And so, I mean, that has been really deeply imprinted on. I love my dad. I love my parents so much. And I know they love me. And I don't have any malice for things that happened, because I know, you know, that they were doing their best. And I don't feel any worse for it, because I was okay anyway. You know, it's, and the yeah. part, the things about me that were not okay, they couldn't help it. You know, it wasn't, they didn't do any of that purposefully. And so just seeing someone that could be construed as your villain from the inside and loving them has totally mm-hmm. changed how I view everyone, you know?
I think that this is such a nugget of pure, pure love that you're giving right here, because this is the way that we do heal. I call it my morning epiphanies. And when I wake up early in the morning is when I have these incredible insights, maybe in the last couple of years, into relationships and what has made people mm-hmm. act. And I remember when somebody who's caused me a great deal of pain and anguish, when mm-hmm. I suddenly woke up one morning and just sort of all these pieces fell into place where I understood, or I thought I might understand a little bit more of what that person's background looked like, and how deeply dysfunctional it must be, and how confused
yes.
and fuzzy that mind must be, and to create such sick actions. And it really was just an interesting process. I don't give myself any credit for it, because it felt like
yeah,
a gift.
No, it's not
it just
anything.
Feels like a gift. An epiphany is a gift of knowledge.
Yeah.
But that has been more healing to me than any kind of rumination on how I've been wronged, or you know, vengeful thoughts, and it is very necessary for us to look at things that were wrong as wrong. I've realized that too. I've been taught that in therapy, that we need to know for sure when boundaries have been violated in harmful ways and deem them as very wrong. But also understanding people in this pure way that you describe. Oh my goodness, it's such a freeing way to live, where we come from a place of people all have demons and pain, and many of them, I would dare say most, are just doing their best.
Yeah. And I remember the exact moment when that changed for me. And it's never been the same since. You know, when my dad changed from someone who was making my life harder to somebody who had a hard life, and I'm not attached to that. You know, it's I will be better because of this, and it's not going to negatively impact me, but it could sure use compassion, you know.
That's everything. And you know, your hardships have really brought you to be this most blinding of light individuals in the world. I'm so lucky to know you. I have to wrap this up, Christine, because I see that we're about to be
yes.
cut off. But okay. I feel so blessed to have you in my life, and to be able to let a little more of Lucia shine for the world. It's my honor.
Thank you, Christy. The feeling is mutual. I love you.
Please follow Land of Lucia wherever you see it, on Facebook. Like her, favorite her, follow her on all the things. I think you've
Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Yeah, I've got
all the places, because this girl's going places, and she will just be such a wonderful bright light and just informative and amusing and just everything good in your life if you do.
Thanks.
I can endorse her. No pressure there. I know it's not.
All right. I mean, there's nothing on there yet, but hypothetically there could be songs.
It's going to be fantastic very soon. Very soon. Thank you, my darling.
Thanks,
love.
Christy.
And have a wonderful day or night, wherever it is where you are. What time is it there?
It's midnight. Midnight. Ooh. 14.
Well, you're acting particularly perky for somebody in midnight. Thanks.
I'm having human contact. That's how it works.
That's it. Thank you. You've made me feel so much happier today.
Thanks, Christy.
And every time I experience you. So. Take care. We'll talk again, I'm sure.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.